Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
A year ago today, that Olympic bobsledder Jeremy Rolleston made it into the sporting history books, but unfortunately it wasn't in the way that he'd really dreamed. It was at the Vancouver Winter Olympics, and he was piloting the bobsleigh that tragically flipped, hurtling out of control down a deadly track at speeds of up to 120 kilometres an hour. That crash made it into Channel 9's top 10 most memorable sporting moments for 2010. You might remember it. It really was quite dramatic. Well, for Jeremy, it was a dream shattered. When he chatted to us last year, just after arriving back in his hometown of Sydney, he was devastated, he was bewildered. But a year on, things are looking up again. He's processed a lot of the emotions and the lessons along that kind of learnt along the way, I guess, and he's written them into a book. It's called A Life That Counts. He's with us to have a chat about it. G'day, Jeremy.
Good evening, Sheridan.
It's good to have you here in the flesh.
Thank you very much.
Oh, man, I really do remember, actually, the conversation that we had. I remember hearing the disappointment in your voice, because you'd been training for how many years to get there?
Yeah, I guess it's a lot of years to get to an Olympics, and for it to end like that was devastating. Absolutely.
It was something about your foot, wasn't it? Your foot injured the stirrup or something?
Yeah, my foot got caught as I got in the sled and it snapped part of the steering. Again, it's so random, never happened in 10 years, and I guess that was one of the hard things, almost akin to, I guess, running onto the rugby field, tripping and breaking your ankle as you run on.
Right. Just stopped it like that. Yeah, as you said, it never happens.
Never happened.
And it never happened for 10 years in the sport.
Yeah, correct. And then of all the times to happen.
All the times to happen.
Anyway, what can you do?
Well, you can write a book, I guess. You can learn the lessons and you can actually write a book about it. So just tell me a little bit, though, when you got back and you were still quite dejected after so many years and then the disappointment, how long did it take you to start to kind of say, all right, let's move on, Jeremy, let's move on? What happened? What was the process from that point on for you?
Yeah, I guess for me it was in two parts. Initially, I had to get over my disappointment very quickly because we needed to decide if we were going to do four-man at the Olympics, and that started in 2 days' time. In the end, we couldn't because of some injuries. But it meant that I had to deal very, very quickly with my emotions. I guess as I came home and then processed after that, it was quite a number of months. And as I sit here a year on and think about where I was a year ago, time certainly heals wounds, but I think I'll never get over the disappointment of what happened. Mm. But that really was one of the catalysts for the book. I guess I was surprised that people couldn't intuitively get the difference between disappointment and regret. And so when they asked me if I regretted giving up my job and all the time, energy, money and passion that I put in, how did I feel about it? Given what happened, and they were surprised when I said I absolutely don't regret it, but I'll forever be disappointed. And understanding that difference was actually one of the key catalysts for writing the book.
Therein lies obviously a lesson in itself, that those two are not equated. You can actually not regret something but still be, and it's probably a point of reality to come to that point and recognizing, well, look, I might always feel a bit disappointed when I think back to that moment. And maybe you kind of give yourself a little bit of space by doing so, rather than saying, well, I should get over it, I should be able to look at the upside or something. No, it actually might be that for years to come I'm going to feel disappointed about that, but it was still worth trying.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for anyone that's facing any sort of disappointment, I guess as you go through the stages of grief and you try and get to a conclusion, for me, even if the conclusion is, I don't think I'll ever understand why it happened that race, I guess it's good for people to understand that you may never get to some fantastic answer. The answer may be, I don't understand. And I guess on the other side, forward looking, it's a fantastic thing for people to know that you always regret the things you don't do more than the things you do. Mm-hmm. And that's a great way to live life, because you think everybody has dreams and visions for their life, but how many people actually go for their dreams? There's a big disconnect there. And a lot of that is, I guess, being held back by the fact that they're not sure that they'll actually get their dreams. But yet, I guess that mantra of if you knew that you'll always regret the things that you don't do, then being able to go for the things that you want is a fantastic way to live life. And I guess I'm someone that has seen you on a high with a good Olympics and talked to you on a low with a terrible Olympics. Mm. And that's one of the messages in my book, which is, again, you know, going after what you dream. Mm.
Jeremy Rolleston is with us. His book is A Life That Counts, two-time Olympian, 1-300-40-2020. If you've got something to add to the conversation, I'd love to hear it. This is Open House right across the nation. So you've gone and picked a few people's brains as you were working through these kinds of things, people like Dick Smith and Gay Waterhouse and Louise Sauvage and other people like that, and kind of collated them all together. Now, just on that notion of dreams, because yes, indeed, often people feel there's a certain sense of fear that I could, if I do step out, if I actually do try something different, well, I'm leaving the safety of what I've actually done. I might even be leaving my income stream. Why should people still be considering dreams anyway, apart from the regret thing?
Yeah, well, look, I absolutely at the outset, it's worth saying that it's never comfortable and there is wisdom attached to all of those decisions. But I think following your heart is a great way to live. And many of us feel boxed in and we feel like we're on a path that's already laid out for us or that we can't get off that path. And I know for me,
that sense of safety is really quite strong, isn't it? You know, people are, I've got an income stream and maybe I've got kids to look after, and you've got to look after your kids, of course. But you can very much feel like, well, okay, my path is actually set before me, and I don't even like it, but it's set before me.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, there is that wisdom that comes into it for me. I didn't have children. So again, that's another dimension that adds to it. But at all stages of levels of people having dreams. But I think there's lots of reasons why you'd want to go after your dreams apart from having regret. There's plenty of studies in the self-help area that talk about successful people are passionate and love what they do, and that inevitable cycle happens in terms of you love what you do, so you spend more time doing it, therefore you tend to be more successful, therefore you love what you do more. And if you ask me about the 10 famous contributors that I had in the book, that is absolutely a common notion that I that just struck me as I interviewed people like Dick Smith and Gay Waterhouse and James Tompkins. They love what they do, and it really starts from there.
It's not work for them. They get up and, you know, full tank of energy because you've got so much interest.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess we then sort of overlay that with most of us who often aren't necessarily following our heart, and conscious motivation dissipates and we don't have it coming from a deep, deep desire of something we love.
You also go into the psychology that's involved in becoming an Olympic sports person, and anybody who obviously is, you know, watching the Olympics, I'll know that there's often quite a lot of comments about, you know, psychological tactics and things when you're about to leap off or do whatever it is. Give us some tips of what kind of psychological tips you can, or tactics you can actually use to overcome the fear of actually starting to go down the path of, you know, what that dream might be.
Good question. I think the first thing that it's good for people to know is that no one is born with this innate belief, this unshakable belief. It's not like Roger Federer rolled over and on day two thought, I'm going to be one of the most amazing tennis players the world's ever seen. So what we learn as sports people is techniques of how to develop that belief that you really can do something, because your belief does determine your expectations and your expectations determine your behavior. If you never think you're going to be able to do something, why would you start it in the first place and set yourself up for failure? So that is the first thing. And we use a lot of techniques within that around visualization and looking at our language, even as far as hypnosis.
Did you undergo hypnosis?
Yeah, I used hypnosis a lot, in the sense that I listened to a CD that I had constructed with my sports psychologist, whereby they weren't hypnotizing me at the time, but I'm listening to a CD that takes me down and then feeds suggestions that I want in my mind to give me the belief that I want to do. Yeah. So I guess one other tip that I would give to people is our language is very powerful, and we know in the Bible that it talks about that. But from a psychological perspective, the brain can't process a negative. So if I said, Sheridan, don't think of a red car, it's exactly what you'll think about, and your brain tries to reverse engineer it. So if you said the same thing two different ways, if you said, that's really hard, or that's not easy, is it? Your brain has just seen two different internal representations, and those two different images have different feelings and sounds attached to it, and that therefore leads to behavior. So how people frame things does make a difference, and a lot of people would put that, I guess, to the side as positive talk, But we as athletes know that to be far more powerful. And I guess as you reflect, you've never come across a successful person, I wouldn't have thought, who's not an optimist.
Mm, very true. Very, very, very true. Okay, I've got a couple of calls that we'll get to in just a second. If you want to say something to Jeremy, if you've got something to throw into the conversation after what we're talking about, I'd love to hear. 1-300-40-2020. Practice. I mean, it's not just simply about dreams, not just simply about thinking right and everything like that. I mean, the sheer amount of hours that goes into becoming an elite athlete is actually staggering. Talk about then the discipline of then, I guess, pursuing that dream.
Yeah, I guess when I wrote the book, I had a few aims. One of them was to inspire people. Another one was to not get to the end of a book and go, okay, you've told me what to do, but you haven't told me how to do it. So I very much wanted to focus on tools and techniques that we used as Olympians and successful people used to actually know how to actually be able to do something that you want to do. I guess one of those sides of that is just the pure hard work and perseverance. And I guess I'm not a fan of books like The Secret, because I think that as much as mindset is good, and that's one part of it, there's a completely other side, which is just called plain hard work. Mm. And I guess for me, it was obvious that I knew how much work that I put in to get to two Olympics. Interviewing the other famous contributors was interesting because, again, you get to see what they've done. A good example of that, I thought, was Gay Waterhouse. I had the opportunity to go and meet her at 4:30 in the morning and stand next to her while she trained her horses. She was telling me she makes her first call in the morning at 2:30 to her foreman in terms of organizing the day.
She's probably been doing that for years.
Doing that. She works 7 days a week. Albeit on a one day, it's only an hour whilst the stables are open to owners. But I guess the point is we don't see that. Mm. And I could give you countless other examples from the people in the book, or again, you know, the listeners will know that intuitively it is that hard work. But I think you really need to have that balance. And if someone doesn't really, really, really want it, then they won't really, really, really do the hard work that's necessary.
So Malcolm Gladwell that talked about, you know, the 10,000-hour rule. You actually have to put in a particular type of 10,000 hours to become an expert at anything.
Yes, and I guess if you just generalise that point, whether or not you agree with the 10,000 hours, you'd absolutely agree with just the concept of hard work. And I guess then the third side of that is a marrying of talents and abilities to hard work. And Dick Smith was actually interesting talking about that, because he talked about, I guess, very early on, he wanted to do one thing and his tutor told him he wouldn't be very good at that. And he had an attitude that where it didn't crush him, and he was very thankful for that. But yet he was always good at electronics, and through the ups and downs of finding his way into that, he very much thinks that one of the big fallacies is that you can get whatever you want. And I guess I guess what he's trying to get across is, again, that marrying of talents and abilities as well.
Yeah, she's basing on something on reality.
I mean, absolutely. We see folks, that in Australian Idol, don't we?
Exactly. I was actually going to use the musical thing, but it's not just the musical idea or theme or environment as well, but so many people who have this kind of dream of becoming something great in a particular area but just don't have the raw materials. Mm. One of the nicest things you can actually do is have somebody say to you, or have had done to you, is actually have somebody say, I think your gifts lie elsewhere. I know somebody who it was not until her kind of early 30s that she actually found what it is that she really was kind of built to do, simply because she was told all during her teenage years, you can do whatever you want, you can do whatever you want, you know, you can do anything, you can become whoever you want to be. She went on a particular course of education, and she wasn't cut out for that. The best thing that could have happened for her, somebody actually had said, you know, you don't seem to have the particular creative flair that is needed for this job or whatever it was. How about you look elsewhere? Great gift. Stick around, Jeremy. I want to ask you, for folks that just do not know what their dream is, what can people do? We'll get to that in just a second. I want to get to Jonathan's call as well. Talking to two-time Olympian Jeremy Rolleston at the moment, just about how do you recover after maybe you've lost a dream, maybe you've been working so hard towards a dream and it kind of fell through at the end. Or how do you discover a dream? Want to get to that in just a second, taking your calls as well. G'day, Jonathan.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you, mate. What's on your mind during our conversation with Jeremy?
I really identified with the difference between regret and disappointment. Mm. Because there were, when I was a young child, we went overseas to do church work, my whole family. And when we got back, I got ill, which was related to stress, and someone suggested it might have been because of the stress living overseas. Mm-hmm. But I felt that I don't regret living overseas doing church work because that was the best thing in my life at that time. Mm. And I believe that was God's plan for me. But I was, of course, I was disappointed that I had some effect from it. But
yes, It's a very helpful distinction, isn't it? That you know, regret and disappointment are not actually the same thing. I think that's what I'll be taking away from the conversation as well. So, Jonathan, just before I let you go, how old were you when you actually went overseas?
I was 6 years old and 11 when we came back.
11 when you came back. And yet that was still formative for you?
Yeah.
Formative years?
Yeah. I was in primary school the whole time.
And how did it shape you, you know, afterwards, even though, like you said, it wasn't happy coming back, how did it shape you and how does it shape you today?
I think it gave me a perspective on the world that other kids in my high school in Australia didn't have. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking about 15, I've had this whole other life in another country and travelling that other kids haven't had. And I think it's given me a bit more outlook onto what other people think and believe living in. We lived in an Islamic society.
Yeah. Okay. Very, very unique experience. Thanks for your call, mate. Thanks for dropping it into the conversation. Jeremy, I think in many ways we have to have the conversation about pain with some of this too, because the disappointment is actually a form of pain. I guess it's an emotional sense of pain when you've been working like you had, worked towards this experience for the Vancouver Winter Olympics last year, and then it just kind of crashing out just at the last moment. It is an experience of pain, and yet some of the greatest things can come out of experiences of disappointment and pain.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, for me personally, I think one side of it is that that is sport. As a Christian, I guess you, and I remember us talking about this when I just came back, really, I guess that's what faith is in a sense, being sure of what you hope for, certain of what you don't see. I certainly didn't have things turn out like I wanted, and I'm really not still sure a year down the track. I don't see necessarily everything being clear in terms of why. But that is my daily wrestle with God about being sure of what I hope for and that he is good and that he has my best in store and that he's for me, not against me. And my wrestle with God is saying, you know, God, I still don't get it. Well, just show me a piece of this fabric and just, you know, let me trust you ongoing. And I guess my story tends to resonate with a lot of people because it's not a constant accession of highs. I've had some great highs and I've had some great lows, and unfortunately some of them have tended to be in the public eye, but it's encouraging to know that I can come out of that and still feel as passionate about following your dreams. And again, I hope encourage people that you may not necessarily know exactly how everything's going to work out, but isn't that faith? And we see it in many forms in our own lives.
Well, I mean, even this book that you have that you've brought out. I mean, you know, A Life That Counts. Would that it actually have been the same kind of book without those disappointments?
Look, no doubt it would have been slightly different. That said, I think one thing that's always resonated with me, and this is where the title of the book, A Life That Counts, comes in, is I guess I'm trying to look at it and say, okay, well, I've seen some amazing things happen. I've seen friends win gold medals right next to me. You know, I've worked in the investment banking world and seen people earn tens of millions of dollars. But still, within a broader context, to what end? Where does that get them in the big scheme of life? Does that satisfy their soul? And that's, I think, often we as Christians can tend to be black or white in that A or B. There's no A or B. It's just a bigger box. I want to go for my dreams with everything I have, with all the talents and abilities God's given me, with every bit of hard work I can muster, with every bit of help that I can do. But I still need to be able to put that in the bigger box of life in terms of how God sees the world.
Indeed. And you've got a nice chapter at the end of the book there. We actually talk about giving back and a number of the charities and the organizations that you champion and that you support. Of course, even that's only a small part of that too.
Absolutely.
I mean, again, from the faith perspective, you will never be able to fill an infinite space with finite things, whether that be dreams or whether that be career paths or whatever it might be. There is that infinite space that actually is for the infinite God.
Absolutely. And I guess that's an important message to give even outside of a Christian context, because we live in a very, very selfish world, and we live in a world that's very much driven by self-interest, and self-help books are an example of that. Then when we overlay that with our faith, you know, we really need to be those people that are making a difference and realizing that we can live our dreams, but again, at the end of the day, what's a profit a man if he gains the whole world yet forfeits his soul?
Tori's on the line, and I think probably what she's going to talk about is pretty apt right about now. Hello, Tori.
Hi, how are you going?
Well, thank you. What are your dreams all about?
Yeah, well, I guess actually it relates to sort of the last bit that I just heard. I guess I'm questioning, how do you know when you think about this idea of following your dreams that your dreams are God's dreams and your dreams aren't just, your own pride or sinful heart? I know for myself a lot of the time the things that I want for myself aren't necessarily focusing on others and wanting to help others. So I guess in all of that, how do you sort of work that out?
Indeed. Any thoughts, Jeremy?
Yeah, I heard an interesting thought on this that I thought was really encouraging. And I guess for me, I haven't personally struggled with this as much, but I think here's some thoughts. I think, one, we're all unique with individual talents and abilities, and I think that is, I guess that is a starting point in terms of knowing what God's put into you. But in another sense, you know, we have verses like, whatever you do, whether in word or deed, you know, do it all for God's glory.
That's it.
I guess that whatever you do is probably the most relevant point. And so in a big context, does it matter what you do? No. Does it matter what your dreams are? No. God's put different things in you than he's put in me. But does it matter? No. Whatever you do. And then the rest of the verse goes on.
I think that's
really quite freeing.
Yeah, indeed. And it actually keeps the focus there, because I'm with Tori. I mean, there's a number of times you think through your dreams and things. You think, Sheridan, who is this dream really for? And I think that's a key thing is, you know, Tori, the whole idea of loving God and loving neighbour as self. And I also run the love test through it. To what degree is this dream actually going to in some way, I guess, point to one of those two grand callings that we've been given, to love God and love our neighbour as ourself? In what way, if this came to fruition, would it actually be, you know, a great benefit and help to other people? It's a bit of a test as well. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, no worries.
Yeah, it's a discerning question, isn't it? It's a discerning question. Let's leave on this. Folks listening who say, "Well, I don't know what my dream is. I don't know. I know I should have one, and I, you know, how do you discover a dream if you're just not sure?"
Yeah, there's a couple of ways that I discuss in my book, and for that very reason, I'm going to release a workbook down the track, which has a whole series of questions. But if I gave you two other thoughts that are probably ones that listeners may not have heard, one is, I call it tears of inspiration. If you were to think about the times when you have cried in movies or in songs and reverse engineered that, we cry when we're most congruent. There's something that touches us deep inside. It could be watching a movie and seeing the happy family, and you sit there and you think, oh, I really want that. If you reverse engineer it and try and think about why am I emotional, that might illuminate some dreams. Another way of doing that is you look and you write down your passions. You write down, what are the things that I love doing? So let's say for me, it could be driving a bobsleigh. If I keep asking the question, why, you will actually distill it down to your base core reasons. And if you did that across a number of passions, you would see a lot of commonalities. So if I said, why do I like driving a bobsleigh? And I came up with five reasons. And one might be the speed.
I was just going to say, because you're a speed freak, yeah.
Yeah. I might then go, well, why do you like the speed? And then I would go, well, I love feeling alive. Like, it makes me feel alive. I can't get that sitting behind a desk. Well, why do you like feeling alive? Well, I want to feel like I'm living life to the full. Well, why do you want to feel like you're living life to the full? Well, because I love that verse in the Bible that says God's come to give me life and life to the full. Now, when I did that to a number of passions, there are a number of commonalities. So there's a way that you can actually use your passions as almost a mirror and work it backwards without necessarily going in and you stopping yourself from coming up with the answers that will inevitably fall out from finding your dreams. But I think the last thing that I would say to people, Sheridan, is a dream isn't something that necessarily takes too much time to think about. It's deep inside. It comes to you. It's not something you think about at night necessarily. It's something that you're always thinking about. It might start small and it might grow, but it's a dream. Mm-hmm. It's something that excites you. It's not something that you have to grab and try and unfold yourself, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's just always on your mind, in the back of your mind. All right, Jeremy, what an interesting conversation. The book is called A Life That Counts. The website is alifethatcounts.com.
.au.
alifethatcounts.com.au. Jeremy, we might talk to you in the future again.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's good to talk to you, mate. Jeremy Rolston, two-time Olympian and now author and speaker.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.